Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast!
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between thinking about photography school and selling your portraits online. It's the difference between giving away those cookies you just made for free and running your cookie empire. A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between having a movie reviewing hobby and a movie reviewing career. Squarespace, because no matter what you're into, a website makes it real. Use offer code THEDIFFERENCE for 30% off every plan. Terms and conditions apply.
The bombing begins again. We try to sort out why the U.S. is attacking Iran. We'll also try to sort out how quickly a new U.S. deal for Venezuelan oil might lower gas prices here in America. And with our politics the way they are right now, we'll ask three Democrats running for Congress why they want to serve in Washington and whether they'd campaign with Hassan Piker or Joe Biden. Hello and welcome to The Takeout. I'm Ed O'Keefe in for Major Garrett on this Monday. The hostilities have returned in Iran for the first time in more than a month, as a war that's dragged on for 6 months wraps up again with no end in sight. The U.S. struck two Iranian rocket launchers over the weekend on an island in the Strait of Hormuz. The American military says Iran was preparing rockets carrying mines there for attack. Iran's Revolutionary Guard warned punishment would be returned and indeed fired on U.S. allies in the region. They launched ballistic missiles at the United Arab Emirates and a Jordanian base housing American troops. In an interview with Fox News, taped before the offensive began, the president shared his often repeated mantra on how well the war is going.
We're doing very well. Their Navy's gone. Their Air Force is gone. Their leaders are gone. All of their anti-aircraft, I mean, it's all wiped out. They're tough people. They're smart people. But they're very evil. They killed 52,000 protesters as of 3 months ago. And sadly, they've added very substantially to that list. Even people that aren't protesting, they go into the houses and they take them and they shoot them. These are very violent, evil people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, Israel would be gone. If I weren't president, Israel would be gone. There would be no Israel. And there would probably be no Middle East.
Amid all this, the American military has been at an intense pace since the outbreak of the war. According to the Washington Post, the heads of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the four-star commanders overseeing U.S. operations in Asia, Europe, and Latin America recently warned Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth that continuing this pace is, quote, unsustainable and risks weakening their ability to confront threats elsewhere, including the U.S. homeland. Let's begin tonight with CBS News senior White House correspondent Weijia Zhang, who's over at the White House. Weijia, what more is the administration saying about these latest attacks?
Well, Ed, we just left the Oval Office a short time ago, and I asked President Trump whether the resumption of these strikes was part of a limited campaign or a return to a full-scale war. And he said it is very limited, adding that Iran is a failed nation, saying that their leaders are dead, their Navy is gone, their Air Force is gone, their surveillance is almost all gone. But even then, he said, that doesn't mean we are not going to smack them. And, of course, what he always likes to say, we'll see what happens. So he was noncommittal in terms of how long these strikes could continue. But we know that he told Fox News in a different interview that he would be hitting Iran hard in retaliation for Iranian strikes in Jordan and the UAE. But, Ed, we should note that after these strikes, the stocks responded by tumbling and the oil prices responded by going up. Two figures that the president is sure to be keeping his eye on as he makes these decisions.
Very good point. Now, how is he responding to this new Washington Post report about the war weakening U.S. capabilities around the rest of the world?
I asked the president about that as well, Ed, and he didn't deny that these warnings existed, that military leaders were sounding alarm bells about what a prolonged operation meant. And here is what he said in response.
We have nothing else in mind. Number two, we're very respected. Nobody else would be crazy enough to do it. Number three, we have so much ammunition and munitions, as they like to call it, all over the world that we can always take from if we want. And this is a relatively little war for us.
So he didn't really answer the question, Ed, about whether this is making it more difficult to confront other threats around the world and right here at home.
A relatively little war for us, he said about Iran. On another matter, right there behind you, the fate of the ballroom, the East Wing, what's left of it, the Supreme Court issuing a ruling this afternoon saying that construction can continue. What else did they say?
That's right, Ed. This just happened a short time ago, and it really is a victory, at least a temporary one, for President Trump, because the Supreme Court ruled that while the lawsuits continue to play out about the legality of the project, that construction can continue, and that replaces a previous order that halted construction. And the Chief Justice, John Roberts, actually sided with the three other liberals on the court, making this a 4-5 decision, and he wrote on behalf of the dissenters, the White House is an iconic American building whose symbolism and history are wrapped up in its architecture. He said it's critical to ensure that those responsible follow the rules in deciding what to tear down and what to build up. He said the project itself is likely unlawful. But to be clear, that is not what the justices ruled on today. They just said that in the meantime, as that question is being answered, these guys, these crews can continue building. Ed.
All the noise behind us there on the North Lawn will continue for the foreseeable future.
We know it well.
Weijie Zhang, yes, we do. Yep. It has made that neighborhood awfully messy looking, but they're getting somewhere with that construction. We'll see. Weijie Zhang over at the North Lawn for us tonight. Thank you for kicking us off. We turn now to CBS News national security analyst Aaron McClain. He is the host of the School of War podcast. You are not here to discuss construction projects or the legality of them, but you are here to discuss the ongoing conflict over there in the Middle East. The importance of the U.S. striking Lark Island in the Strait of Hormuz, what is it?
So the Iranians and the United States military have been fighting for months a battle for control of the Strait of Hormuz. According to Central Command on Larak Island, which is this key piece of terrain right in the middle of the strait, they detected rockets laden with mines to strike ships that were ready to be fired. So they preempted that by striking. The Iranians then retaliated. Iran obviously has an interest in remining the strait. The fact that America can get out a fair amount of oil, we don't know exactly how much, the administration claims it's a lot each night under cover of darkness, is a problem for Iran. It reduces Iran's leverage over the global economy. So you see them attempting to reestablish control and us resisting it.
The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, says it intercepted an Iranian drone, and its defense minister says the attack is, quote, a dangerous escalation. They're obviously a power in that region. What happens should the UAE decide to step up its military response?
Well, we have seen over the course of the war since February some involvement here and there from the UAE, and obviously a fair amount of support from the UAE to the American war effort. You know, it would, in certain respects, complicate things. The UAE and Iran have their own territorial disputes, to include over islands that are out there in or near the Strait of Hormuz that have long historical antecedents and all sorts of tangled claims. The complicated regional geopolitics of that region are sort of layered underneath the broader U.S.-Iran competition that's going on. America, no doubt, would welcome more support from its partners in the region, but it would definitely be complicating as well.
Do they even have that big of a military to participate with?
Big, no, but what they do have can be quite capable. They have air assets that are pretty significant. And keep in mind, they've been involved in conflicts in places like Yemen and in various places of Africa for some time now.
Good point. What to make of this Washington Post report on the various commanders, the heads of the service branches, telling the Secretary of Defense, hey, the rest of the world requires U.S. military attention as well, and you're stretching us thin.
Look, on one level, disputes between different combatant commands over resources is not a big news story.
Yeah.
On another level, multiple combatant commands formally non-concurring or disagreeing with the course of the Secretary of War's decision-making in a formal process does seem significant. And what it does is it puts on the record something that we all know, that the war in Iran was meant to last for a few weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, the president repeatedly said. Here we are now on the cusp of September, and some level of hostilities are continuing even over the weekend. And that comes at a cost. It comes at a cost to American forces in the Pacific, in Europe, and elsewhere.
Aaron McLean, School of War podcast, CBS News National Security Analyst. Thank you as always.
Thank you.
Good to see you. A search and recovery mission is underway in the Grand Canyon after deadly flash flooding ripped through the national park over the weekend. At least two people are dead and more than a dozen others are believed to be missing. Heavy rainfall triggered the flash flood, sweeping boulders, infrastructure, and debris into the Colorado River. The National Park Service is calling on anyone who knows of someone who was hiking or backpacking at the time of the floods to inform park authorities immediately. We are joined by CBS News chief correspondent Matt Gutman, who's on the southern rim of the Grand Canyon in Arizona. Matt, what is the latest as we understand it?
Ed, I mean, I want you to just see what's behind us and the rain that's coming down, how soaked I am from just a few minutes out here. This kind of weather, and it's basically the similar monsoon bands that have pummeled this area for the past several days, has completely socked in the Grand Canyon. That means that what you're not hearing behind me is the buzzing sound of helicopters. It has basically significantly hampered rescue operations today. Now, the Park Service believes that there may be about 15, they're not quite sure, people still missing in the canyon. They have confirmed that they have recovered the remains of two people. We are expecting an update in the next couple of hours, but rescue operations, I think, as they would like to have them, are not happening right now because of this persistent weather, Ed.
Was there any warning in advance that the floodwaters would get as bad as they did?
No, there was really little warning. People knew there were monsoons, but that is the typical weather pattern in this time of year in this part of Arizona. From June to September, there are monsoons. They unleash a significant amount of rain. What happened here is there was anywhere from a half an inch to an inch of rain in about half an hour. A massive deluge. And what also happened is it hit areas that have burn scars on them. Parts of northern Arizona have had significant fires in recent years. There's nothing to absorb that water, so it essentially acts like glass. The rain comes sliding right off it, taking the burn scars, the charred material, debris from those fires with it. That's why a lot of people described creeks and rivers looking black as the creeks and rivers rose. So it's kind of a confluence of some very terrible events and weather patterns that have happened here in this part of Arizona over the past couple of years.
And as you described it, they're still considered missing, in part because some parts of this canyon are so remote, there's a good chance they're alive, but they're just not within cell phone range?
That's right. The only way down into the canyon from basically the entire southern rim and the northern rim is on foot, by mule, or helicopter. There are no roads. And you can see the crags. I don't know if you can. It's a little bit hazy, but there are millions of crags in here, and it is very hard to get cell phone coverage in there. There's also a language barrier. They believe that many of the people who are missing may be tourists. They may be from other countries. Their families may not have been able to contact local authorities or authorities here in Arizona to tell them that their loved ones may be missing, and that may be part of the problem. The other issue is the conditions, right? It is, I don't know, just about 60 plus degrees here right now. The rain is coming down. Exposure, hypothermia are major concerns if there are people still stuck in the canyon, and then they might have been now for going on 48 hours. That could pose a very significant hazard for anyone who might have survived and is trying to get to rescuers or rescuers are trying to get to them. That's probably the biggest concern right now, Ed.
Yeah. Well, and as we've pointed out, it is so grand that they're, of course, still allowing visitors in to the park at all ends. But obviously, the mission to rescue those people continues. Matt Gutman there on a rainy day at the Grand Canyon. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks to Matt and his crew. Still to come on The Takeout, my conversation with three Democratic congressional candidates. Their campaign strategies with just more than 2 months to go before the midterm. 63 days to be exact. Mark your calendars. Also, President Trump is standing behind data centers. Our reporters invited in this Monday will weigh in on the growing political debate over AI data centers. Plus, how much money did someone win this weekend for winning a Mayor Mamdani lookalike contest? Well, we'll tell you and give you a look at the winner. What a city. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. And oh, by the way, go Knicks. Welcome back to The Takeout. You talk to Democrats across the country running congressional campaigns. They're pretty confident heading into the midterms, as the polling suggests they're in good shape. But the party is also debating its future. Earlier today, we spoke with three Democratic candidates running for Congress. Marnie Von Wilpert, who's a San Diego council member running in California's 48th district. Christina Hines, a former special victims prosecutor running in Michigan's 10th district, just north of Detroit. And Zach Dembo, a former federal prosecutor running in Kentucky's 6th district around the Lexington area. Here was our conversation. Let me start with a kind of basic question, but one I think a lot of people ponder given the politics of today. Why on earth did you want to run for Congress? We'll start with the ladies and we'll work our way down.
No, thank you for having us today. Yeah. I'm running for Congress to stand up to Donald Trump and fight for a better future for America. You know, I've spent my whole career in public service fighting for this country. I joined and served the United States Peace Corps during the AIDS epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, so you better believe I'm going to fight to restore USAID in our foreign service. I then went on to serve as a civil rights lawyer in Mississippi. So I care deeply about restoring the Voting Rights Act. And I got to prosecute major corporations as a deputy city attorney. And so I want to take on corruption in D.C. I'm running to fight to lower our cost of living, which in Southern California is out of reach for so many families, to protect our access to health care and protect our personal freedoms from the Trump administration.
All right.
Yeah. Christina? It is a crazy time to be running for Congress. And I think one of the reasons that I wanted to run is because I don't think that Congress is actually working for working families anymore. I think, you know, I say in the trail a lot, there are more millionaires in Congress than there are moms, just regular, ordinary people that are trying to actually make it in this world. And I want to go and try to, you know, actually fight for working families, for the people that are struggling to be able to make their house payment, pay for gas. I mean, it cost me $73 to fill up our minivan the other day. And that's really expensive when gas is over $4 a gallon in Michigan. So we need some actual fighters for working people.
Okay. You know, in addition to there being too few moms in Congress, the number of veterans in Congress mm-hmm. has gone from 75% during the 70s to less than 18% now. And I was fortunate to serve in the Navy on active duty. And like the other great guests here, a long career in public service in the classroom, in the courtroom, most recently a federal prosecutor in my hometown of Lexington. And what we're not seeing in Congress is that kind of public service, that focus on others. We're seeing, especially whether it's the administration, the Republican majority, or frankly, some career politicians on the Democratic side, they think their job is to get reelected and stay as long as they can. And I wanted to change that. I wanted to bring public service back to Congress so we can actually be fighting for constituents and bring these prices down and take on this corruption.
You all mentioned the cost of living, which is the number one concern of voters that we talk to in person and that we see reflected in polling. Give me an example of something specific you would do or you would introduce as a member of Congress to help drive down the cost of living. Zach, we'll start with you.
I love this question because all it means is for Congress to do its job. The Constitution already says Congress has control over tariffs. And even though these tariffs have been struck down as illegal multiple times, this Congress has sat by while tariff after tariff comes in and jacks up costs for Central Kentucky. I'm thinking especially of the bourbon industry in my district. Yep. Already crushed by the tariffs. And then most recently, we had this announcement of this 50% trade war with Canadian tariffs, which again is going to hurt the bourbon industry's ability to go to its largest external market, all for no reason, in a way that's hurting Kentucky consumers, adding $1,000 to their household budgets. So that's something we can fix on day one because we already have the power. We just have a Congress that's too spineless to stand up and do it.
So hold up or down votes on the tariffs and you would vote against them.
Yes.
And that you believe would drive down the costs and certainly help industries in your state. Christina?
Yeah. I mean, the trade war with Canada is directly impacting Michigan, too, right? So our district is just north of Detroit, Macomb County, part of Oakland County. We're 40 minutes away from one border crossing and 20 minutes away from another border crossing. Our biggest industries are manufacturing and defense and aerospace. And these industries are being hurt so badly by this trade war with Canada, by the tariffs. And not only raising the cost of living, I mean, people in our district have paid over $1,700 more this year as a result of these tariffs, but people are losing their jobs. General Motors laid off over 1,000 people in our district as a direct result of these tariffs. And so not only are people struggling more than ever with their bills, but people all over our district, not only big corporations, but small businesses, are closing their doors.
So the specific thing you do then to fight the cost of living is...
Congress needs to take back the power of the purse, and we need to stop these tariffs.
Is there anything, since you mentioned you're a mother running, is there something specific you've thought about in terms of working families or addressing childcare concerns or transportation or anything else like that?
I mean, to be fair, everything that I think of comes back to working families because, you know, one of the biggest reasons I'm running is that I have this belief that our kids deserve the same rights and freedoms and opportunities or even more than we had growing up. Childcare is huge, right? We have childcare deserts all over our district. And when you have, for women, if you have to drive more than a mile to your daycare facility, you're 7% more likely to drop out of the workforce entirely. And so right now, we actually need more people in our economy working in these jobs, but it's so hard to find childcare. And when you do, you're paying an arm and a leg for it. So we do. We need to expand real, accessible, and affordable childcare for folks. We need to have world-class schools in this country, and we need a generation of leaders that's actually going to focus on those things.
So finding federal ways to pay for more affordable childcare, then, it sounds like, is what you're saying, would be one specific thing, in addition to voting against the tariffs, right? Yeah,
Congress needs to be laser-focused on lowering the cost of living for everyday Americans. You know, I've already fought for lower costs. As a prosecutor, I went after price gougers who were ripping us off during the pandemic. In San Diego, I found out teachers were leaving our classrooms because they couldn't afford to live there. So I started the first teacher down payment assistance grant program with private developer money to make sure they could buy houses in our district, and it's working. They're staying in classrooms. When I get to Congress, I'm going to fight hard to lower our costs by, one, voting against the tariffs, two, restoring affordable health care. We should protect Medicaid, Medicare, restore the Affordable Care Act so people can afford to see a doctor. And finally, we're going to stop this corruption that's making Donald Trump rich at the cost of expense of all of us.
Okay. The other thing we hear a lot from voters is, yeah, I'm not a fan of the president or he hasn't delivered on what I want, but I couldn't tell you what the Democratic Party stands for. Do you hear any of that from voters?
Yeah.
What's your answer?
Well, I have a lot of Trump voters in my family. You know, like I have people that I love that vote for Donald Trump, but I think there's two things. First of all, Trump promised us America first. He promised us a lower cost of living. It hasn't delivered on either of those things. And I agree with some of that criticism. For a long time, Democrats have not actually been doing the work of helping working families either. And so I think that it is. It's incumbent on all of us to actually step up and not only fight for working families in our districts, but stand up to people in our own party when they're not fighting for working families.
Zach. What does it mean to be a Democrat?
Yeah, well, I can't tell you what it means to be a Democrat nationally, never run for office before. I can tell you what it means to be a Kentucky Democrat, right? Governor Andy Beshear in our state, who I was privileged to work for, has really, I think, shown the way about how Democrats can show up, not just in urban or suburban areas, but importantly, speak to rural voters too. And what it means is showing up, being an advocate for farmers, especially at a time where we have an anti-agriculture, anti-farmer administration in Congress, being an advocate for veterans at a time that I think we have an anti-veteran, anti-military Congress. I don't know how you could see the Abraham Lincoln situation with the sailors any differently than seeing these folks do not respect our men and women in uniform. So it's about making sure that you are willing to break with the party when you need to, because all that matters ultimately is not what party you are, it's your constituents and serving them. And that's what I think both parties have lost sight of. And I'm excited for a new crop of leadership of public servants to come in and change that.
In the Southern California region, what does it mean to be a Democrat?
So for Democrats to win, we can't just be against Trump. We also have to be for a better future for our country. You know, that's why I'm running on a platform of protecting our affordable health care. You know, really speaking to people about why it's costing nearly $7 at the pump in San Diego because this war in Iran. It's showing people that we are listening and governing for them. You know, this country hasn't raised the minimum wage in decades. If we want to actually restore workers' rights, we have to pass the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize, which I helped write when I was a labor lawyer for Obama. We need people to have good jobs, good wages that are protected from tariffs, protected from Donald Trump's attacks on our economy. And that's what we as Democrats need to do is step up and fight and govern when we get there.
You're all in your 30s or 40s,
yep.
Right? There is the latest generational clash tomorrow in Massachusetts, 80-year-old Ed Markey facing 47-year-old Seth Moulton, a little older than you guys. And the primary argument there is I'm a younger, more in tune potential senator than the 80-year-old Markey. How has the generational issue come up in your campaign? I know you mentioned it, Christina, but the fact that, are you hearing from voters, or what are they saying about the need for that, if at all?
My Republican opponent is endorsed by Donald Trump, and he is much older than me. He's in his 70s, and I'm fighting for seniors farther than he is. He wants to renew the big, ugly bill that'll take away Medicare. It'll not protect Social Security and Medicaid, whereas I've pledged to undo this and protect our seniors from rising costs. You know, it's not someone's age. It's what they're going to do in Congress. He'll be another rubber stamp for Donald Trump, and I'll fight back to actually take our country back and fight for us.
Jack?
I will say one of the few silver linings, I turned 40 during this campaign, which I don't think of as particularly young, but I'm still considered a young Democrat by the standards. And so it's so pleasant to meet so many people of all parties who say, we need new blood in there. We need a fresh face. And I think that's getting to what we're talking about kind of the problems at the root of DC corruption is this group of folks who got here when they were young and never passed the torch. Never handed it over. And so I think when we get new folks in who come from an earlier, from a younger generation, I think that's what's going to give us the ability to bridge the gap between seniors and the Gen Zers and figure out a way that we can bring everyone forward together. Because look, these affordability issues, they're not based on age. They're hurting everyone. And we need folks who can talk to all generations to do that.
I will just add that I think most of the young people I know that are running for Congress, and I think, like Zach said, I'm young by Congress standards, but my kids all think I'm ancient. So I'm like somewhere in the middle. But,
I know the feeling.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that we all still really like respect and honor the people that did come from, you know, before us and that have built a lot of amazing things in America. But at this point, I think that we do need new ideas, and we need people who are willing to work across the aisle to get good work done and who care less about whose name is on something than on the actual help that we're providing families all over this country. And, you know, all three of us were prosecutors at some point. And I can tell you, it's very difficult sometimes to make the changes that we need in systems without young people helping lead the way, whether that's, you know, the online exploitation of kids. I mean, I have to watch my kids grow up with cell phones and social media in a way that I didn't have to do, and that I think most of the people at this table didn't. We need people in Congress who are going to advocate to, you know, keep our kids safe online. And if we only have folks that are in their 70s and 80s, that might not be their top priority.
Yeah, it's difficult for folks to regulate AI when they're still getting used to email.
Yeah, yeah, I see your point. I have a lightning round show of hands set of questions I want to ask you guys. I almost don't want you to look at each other as you decide to answer this. Raise your hand if you would be willing to campaign with Hassan Piker. I thought that might be the answer. Raise your hand if you would be willing to campaign with Joe Biden. Why not? He's the former president.
Again, I have a lot of respect for the people who have served this country in many different forms. But I am not focused on any of these people from outside Macomb and Oakland County. I'm not. Like, all that I care about is actually serving the people there. And I would be rather going to doors or doing meet and greets in my place with, like, my people than bringing people from D.C. or anywhere else into Macomb County.
Will you campaign with Abdul El-Sayed?
If Abdul is in our area, I am absolutely happy to, you know, show up with him. But again, to me, this is about our people in Macomb and Oakland who have not had a fighter. We have had a Republican that never shows up for us. That's why I want to focus on actually showing up for them.
Who would campaign with Kamala Harris?
Yeah, I will, and I'm going to, actually.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris is going to come to my district. You know, I'm in a neck-and-neck close race to flip a district red to blue against a Donald Trump-endorsed MAGA Republican. And it's going to be tough. You know, I'm in one of the districts in California that we specifically fought back against Texas when they gerrymandered for Trump. California fought back. I'm in one of the new districts we need to win to flip the House. My district voted for Kamala Harris by much more of a majority than Donald Trump, so she is going to come and she's going to help me. At the end of the day, though, What people want to see is how I'm going to fight for them locally, how I'm going to make D.C. work for the working families of my district, and that's what I'm focused on delivering.
You said yes.
I think if you're talking about Kamala coming for her future run, I will welcome anyone that wants to run for president into our district because I want them to know how important this district is. And so I'll take them on the whole tour and they can see all of Macomb County and our businesses and our amazing community so that they know that they need to fight for us.
But what about you?
Look, I'm laser focused on the 16 counties in this district. And I'll tell you, respect for anyone who's been in politics before, but I'm campaigning as a new voice, and frankly, I don't think it's helpful to bring up old voices. And look, you look at the stats, frankly, the people of the Kentucky 6th resoundingly rejected Joe Biden's legacy and Kamala Harris's legacy. I don't think that it makes any sense to come in and try to tell them they were wrong. I think it makes sense to come in and tell them there's another way, and that those folks who voted for Trump, understanding what they were trying to do, he's betrayed the trust that they put in him. He's betrayed what he promised them. So we need to find a new way. I want to look forward and not back.
And you'd campaign with homeboy Andy Beshear.
Well, I have to campaign with the governor of Kentucky, of course.
And final one, who here votes for Hakeem Jeffries as leader of the House Democrats?
I will be.
You know, I am going to vote for whoever is going to fight the hardest for working people in Macomb and Oakland County.
Okay, undecided.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 63 days, and I'm not thinking past those 63 days. I don't even know who's going to be a candidate, so I can't even speculate on that yet.
All right. Well, Zach Dembo of Kentucky, Christina Hines of Michigan, Marnie Von Wilpert of California, all Democrats running for Congress this November. Be safe out there. Thank you for stopping by here. And should you win, we expect you back.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Win, we win. And thank you for having us.
We should note we've extended similar invitations to congressional Republican candidates and look forward to having them on because the takeout is a safe space for everyone. Next, a look at the ongoing search for survivors in Nepal following last week's deadly flooding. Stay with us. You are watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Here's a look at what else we're watching this evening. Overseas in Nepal, rescuers are still searching for survivors from last week's deadly flooding as more than 4,200 remain missing and more than 900 people are dead. Emergency crews are trying to reach hundreds of workers believed to be trapped inside a hydropower site, which was buried in mud. Back here at home, Vice President J.D. Vance was in Sterling Heights, Michigan today for a rally at a manufacturing plant. His visit marks the first time he's visited the Wolverine State this election cycle. During his remarks, the VP focused on the importance of the U.S. trucking industry. And what you're watching here, it's just a bunch of New Yorkers doing New York things. Hundreds turned out near Washington Square Park in New York City to judge a Mayor Zohran Mamdani look-alike contest. The winner went for the iconic Mayor Mamdani in a Knicks jersey and suit look. You'll remember that from April or June. Was it June? It was June. Well, it was a wonderful spring for Knicks fans. The look-alike there went even as far as having the matching haircut and facial hair. If you were just turning right there, you wouldn't know the difference necessarily. What did he win? Well, he won a grand prize of $100. Good for him. Maybe he can stand in for the mayor one night. Next, how the Trump administration is defending the new oil agreement with Venezuela. We'll speak with a senior Trump administration official about what exactly this deal entails. Stay with us. You're watching The Takeout.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
President Trump is downplaying concerns about a new oil reserve agreement with Venezuela as part of a partnership with a private business. The U.S. is going to control 65 billion barrels of Venezuela's oil reserves. 17 oil fields would be developed, giving the United States about 55% of the total output. The agreement is set to last for 100 years, but oil industry experts say it could be years before the operation is actually up and running. Earlier today, CBS's Weijia Zhang asked the president about this new agreement.
Analysts predicted that a thing like this could never happen, too. Nobody ever thought it was possible. Remember, Russia was there, China was there. They're not there anymore, are they? You know who's there? USA is there. It'll go fast, much faster than what the analysts, they say 2 years, 3 years. But if it was 2 years, that's a, you know, short period of time.
We're joined now by Chris Pilkerton. He is the Assistant Secretary for Investment Security at the U.S. Treasury, one of the departments involved in this agreement. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us. We'll explain why you're in Asheville, North Carolina towards the end here, but let's start with a pretty basic question I think is on the mind of a lot of people as they hear about this. How soon can an American driver expect this agreement to help drive down gas prices?
Well, Ed, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here. Look, I think you just had sort of the latest comments from the president. Obviously, he's got the most breaking news on this. The reality is that across all of the different agencies, including the work that Secretary Bessent is doing at Treasury in support of the president's goal to be able to bring gas prices down. And that's really across the board when it comes to not just gas, but other goods as well. And we're here at the G20. We're talking with all of our allies and partners about trade deals and ways that we can work together to help growth. Growth is the number one word around here, and we're seeing it in a lot of different sectors in some of the deals that the president's making right now.
So not even the president necessarily committed to when the price of gas would come down. He said it could take several years to develop this. Is it safe to say it's not coming necessarily this year then, thanks to this deal?
I certainly wouldn't speculate on timing, but the reality is what the president is showing is that the country is committed to working with our allies and partners, to working with Venezuela and the Venezuelan people, and to be able to really rise the tide, you know, not just for the Venezuelan people, but for the American consumer. So no specific timeline as far as breaking news here, but obviously it's great news and we're going in the right direction.
And as I understand it, there is a private company involved. There's financing that comes from the Pentagon. You guys at the Treasury Department are obviously involved. The State Department's involved. How's this going to work exactly?
So I think the details of that are still being finalized. There's obviously a framework for that agreement, and the president and a number of the secretaries have spent a lot of time focused on that. But I think what you're seeing, and you saw some information from Secretary Rubio, and you have Secretary Wright and you have Secretary Bessent all at the table. This is my second time in a presidential administration. I was in the first Trump administration. And one of the things that's consistent across the board in all of the issues is the interagency collaboration on all of these areas, particularly around economic and national security. As you know, I oversee investment security, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And Treasury is certainly known for finance, but it plays a very significant national security role, as we've seen recently over the several weeks and some of the announcements that have come out from Secretary Bessent. But ensuring that all these agencies are rowing in the same direction is not something that happens in every administration, and it's certainly happening now.
You're at the G20 finance ministers meeting, or the Treasury Secretary's equivalence meeting there in North Carolina, ahead of the big G20 later this year in Doral, Florida. The Russian finance minister was invited to this summit against the objections of several European countries. Why was he invited?
So the Russian finance minister came as part of the G20. There was a meeting with the Russian finance minister and Secretary Bessent earlier today. And the message was very clear that Secretary Bessent, under the leadership of President Trump, wants world peace. And so that was delivered very clearly, and I think hopefully we'll be able to see some results from that soon.
Why did he have to come to Asheville to be told that, especially, again, when closer allies, closer economic partners are saying we should be isolating Russia, not necessarily welcoming them back into the fold?
Look, the reality is whenever you can have conversations during a war, when you can have a dialogue to be able to stop that, and to be able to save lives and help the Ukrainian people and even the Russian people that are being, you know, hurt by this, I think you need to have that dialogue. And that's exactly what Secretary Bessent did today.
All right. Chris Pilkerton, who is the Assistant Secretary for Investment Security at the Treasury Department. Thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of the summit. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, the House of Representatives is back in session. Our reporter panel weighs in on what is on the docket as lawmakers are already eyeing the exits for the midterms. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. There you have it. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker over the weekend became a Guinness Book of World Records record holder, alongside nearly 2,000 other Chicagoans. The record is for taking a shot of Malort at the same time. For the uninitiated, this is a very bitter liquor. He likes talking about it a lot. The event, we should point out, benefited a Chicago soup kitchen. Certain diehards from the land of Lincoln love the stuff. He talks about it all the time. I've tried it. It's not the greatest drink in the world, but maybe it's an acquired taste. But anyway, big kudos to the governor. And wow, they really enjoy that stuff there, don't they? Welcome back in here to the takeout and the takeout bar, the takeout tavern. My first time behind the bar. Major set this up if you're unfamiliar with it. I'm joined by Kadia Goba, reporter for Notice, News of the United States. Mariana Sotomayor, a Capitol Hill correspondent for PUC. Ladies, thanks for being here. Cheers. Happy Monday.
Cheers.
I cannot believe we're doing this, but we are. I wanted to start with some issues that a former and potentially future member of Congress had recently with Kalshi, the prediction company. They have banned former Congressman George Santos, essentially for betting on himself. And then they banned another, because he bet on his attendance at this year's State of the Union address, right?
Correct.
And he said, thanks for the lifetime ban. Let's see how much longer you guys are around for. Interesting. And then there was a congressional candidate in North Carolina, right? A Republican who basically bet on herself.
Yes.
And owned it and said, yeah, not my greatest move.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's Lori Buckout. She is a Republican who's challenging Don Davis, a Democrat in North Carolina.
This is one of the competitive races, right?
Very competitive, though it is a Trump district. They would have won had it existed in 24 by 11 points. So it should be an easy win. And I was just talking to some people on Davis's campaign, and they described it as a huge sigh of relief. They are really watching this race as one that, you know, could be difficult for him to win. But this brings in a broader conversation that's happening on Capitol Hill, which is corruption. Both parties really trying to define the other as corrupt. This will be easier for Davis to do that, to pin it on Buckout. But, you know, there's this broader conversation happening on the Hill about prediction markets. Mm-hmm. And it's bipartisan. And I don't think that issue is going away. If anything, it's very interesting that Kalshi is being so transparent, putting these names out there saying, hey, we flagged this to the federal government. Maybe because they are anticipating a House Democratic majority, hoping that they don't go aggressively into investigating them. But that's obviously not a sure bet, since it is a very bipartisan issue.
Given how poorly they're paid up there on Capitol Hill, could you, I mean, isn't there almost a thirst to potentially, with nothing stopping them from doing so, for the most part, put in some bets on things that they know are going to happen?
It's certainly the argument that people have proposed, considering that they've been trying to stop stock trades for a while now. So this is an issue that they've been grappling with for a while. And one of those issues, or one of the reasons, is because they say that they are paid way less.
Yeah.
I would also tap, you know, add to Mariana's statement about the congressional members, George Santos, or Kalshi's participation, he has a lifetime ban, as opposed to Lori Buckout, who only was banned for 3 years. So I think they're being judicious about it. You know, they said he didn't, you know, cooperate with the investigation. She did. I mean, it's a big difference in how much he was fined, $70,000 compared to $2,000.
But this is something they're going to have to take up again at some point in the new year once the new Congress begins.
Absolutely.
The issue is the current Congress. The House is back. Why on earth are they back before Labor Day?
Yeah.
And what are they going to get done?
They need to fund the government. Remember, there was this continuing resolution that is ending. So they need to fund the government. All the rumors on the Hill is that that's going to happen, and then they are going to go home. Primarily because we have the midterms coming up, and no one wants to vote on anything that's super controversial, especially things like the SAVE Act or anything like that before the midterms, because it just gives fodder and ammunition for the other party.
With our remaining 45 seconds, is there anything else conceivably that moves before the election besides the basics?
I don't think so. I mean, the Senate will come back. They're going to try and pass the Clarity Act. That, I don't think, is going to move, is what we're hearing. And that's the one thing that the House is waiting for, like Kadia said, especially on the Republican side in the House. They don't want to put anything on the floor that could potentially divide Republicans. And also attendance is an issue. Already hearing that both sides, Republicans and Democrats, not many people showing up for work this week. Yeah. And that's going to continue to be a problem.
They also need to go to the Republican midterm convention next week. Because you know everyone's going to show up for that.
No, they're not.
Kadiagova, Mariana Sotomayor, Notice, Puck, both worth checking out. Happy Monday, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm Ed O'Keefe. This is The Takeout. You watch The Daily Report. I'm going to have a sip of this. Have a good Monday.
Paramount Plus is your streaming home for another unbelievable season of the NFL on CBS.
And here he goes.
Every Sunday.
Touchdown!
The most anticipated games.
Lamar going deep.
Oh, what a catch!
Football's biggest stars.
That's old-fashioned Josh Allen football.
And all the unforgettable moments.
There it is! This is history!
Sign up for Paramount Plus today and stream the NFL on CBS all season long.
See you Sunday!